and we're back with another episode of Gladio for Europe. I'm Russian Sam, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts, Liam.
Hey!
And hello, Sam.
Hello.
We're going to talk about a show. It's called The Last Kingdom. We're going back to the Anglo-Saxon England. I have thoughts about it. It's a BBC show that first aired in 2015.
I think it's still going, too. Yeah, I think that we can compare it to something like Game of Thrones or Vikings. There was and is this real interest in kind of medieval fantasy in like starting in the mid-2010s. And this is an example of the BBC trying to ride that wave. And so they don't have the budget of a Game of Thrones. And I think it kind of shows.
It very much shows.
But to the show's credit, the source material they're working off of, which is a series of novels by Bernard Cornwell, are pretty interesting. So there's a pretty good well they can draw from. And so I think this series is kind of a mixed bag.
Personally, I thought it was incredibly boring and the production values just were not what I expected. Maybe I should have lower expectations a bit, but I just was not very interested in this.
Yeah, it's a BBC show. It's not HBO. I think one thing that's kind of funny is that the art design also is a little more generic than I would have liked. It seems that they're more inspired by Skyrim than actual history with the way the characters look.
Yeah, I just very actively dislike the show. Like, first of all, it's incredibly boring. I had a lot of trouble actually finishing the season because I just couldn't make myself care about these people and their tribulations all that much. The acting isn't great. The costumes look like something out of a high school theater production. And there are a lot of anachronisms.
Yeah, there are. I agree. But the reason why I think the show is interesting and why I wanted to talk about it in this episode is because it's one of the only bits of pop culture that goes into this pretty interesting period. And that period that we're going to talk about today is Viking raids and settlement in England, which I think is a really interesting topic that has some kind of fun implications for the present.
It is, and that's kind of why I was disappointed by the show, because it's such an interesting topic, and they kind of totally missed the mark on what could have been really interesting.
I think a good comparison could be the Hernan show about the Aztecs that we mentioned a few months ago.
I felt the same way about Boardwalk Empire also. Prohibition's an awesome period, but goddamn, they just...
You know what? We've given our thoughts. Halal Sim, why don't you tell us what the show The Last Kingdom is really about?
So the story is about Uhtred, who's a 12-year-old in 866, and the Grand Heathen Army, think about that term, it's important, comes to the shores. So his father and two other kings of Northumbria are killed in a battle, and Uhtred has to witnesses his father's death. And he tries to fight the Vikings, but his life is spared because... I don't know, he's a kid punching them, and they like his fighting spirit.
Yeah, they adopt him. They end up kind of bringing him into the family.
Oh, he's a Viking at heart, basically.
Yeah, he fights like a Dane, they say. He becomes a slave of Ragnar, along with Brita, and is ultimately, they're adopted into the family, and they raise, despite him being a slave, they raise him like a son.
Yeah, so it's definitely no parallel to, like, American slavery. But unfortunately for Uhtred, his adopted family is really quickly killed by a rival, and because he's an outsider, Uhtred is blamed. And the rumors start spreading that Uhtred is actually the one who killed his own family.
And then he makes himself known to his uncle, who is...
Yeah. He ends up making his way down to Wessex, most importantly.
He goes down to Wessex. He ends up in Alfred's court and ends up help turning the tide and gives Wessex knowledge of these Viking ways that he's learned and experienced and seen. Their thinking, their strategies, and their way of life. Because he's raised by these people.
Yeah, he plays the role for the Anglo-Saxons that someone like the Malin Che in the Aztec show played. He's in between different societies, so he can kind of be a liaison.
He's a diaspora kid. He's writing slam poetry about how he feels home neither among the Danes nor the English.
Yes, Uhtred is a diaspora scald, yeah. And again, like you mentioned, this is a series of books by Bernard Cornwell, who's a pretty well-known British historical fiction writer, probably one of the most famous. He also did those books called Sharp, which kind of made Sean Bean famous when they made a TV series about them, but the Napoleonic Wars. And he also has a whole series of books about the, like, supposedly reconstructing the origins of King Arthur, which is kind of cool. So yeah, so that's what the show's about. Clearly Cornwall is really interested in, you know, British history. And even though you guys didn't like the show so much, I think that it's a pretty interesting topic. And I think that Cornwall does a cool job constructing these characters, some of whom are based on real people, some of whom are just real historical figures that kind of show us a broad overview of this really crazy time period in England.
Do you know how faithful the show is to the books?
from what I understand, the episode-by-episode plots are basically constructed for the show. But the broader arc of, like, you know, is the broader arc is faithful to the books.
Yeah, so two episodes ago, we talked about Anglo-Saxon England a bit. And Sam, do you remember where we left off?
So there's a thing called the Heptarchy, which consolidated into four kingdoms. There's East Anglia, Mercia, Northumbria, and Wessex. And they had varying relations over time with the Viking, with each other and outsiders, and they'd submit to each other from time to time.
One thing I would kind of want to add here is that, the name East Anglia, like, means angle. The name Wessex means, like, West Saxon. But it seems like that by this late, we're talking the 800s, the 9th century, it doesn't seem like those tribal distinctions really mattered that much anymore. It seems like you sort of had this English or Anglo-Saxon identity already consolidating by the time the Vikings got there.
Well, I wouldn't really say that. It seems to me more like they continued to be separated until the Viking threat suddenly showed up and they suddenly had to come to terms with the fact that, okay, we may not like each other very much, but these Danes, they're much worse, so let's try to get our shit together.
That's a great point. That's very possible as well.
But yeah, the Mercians were the dominant ones until like 825. And then Wessex became the dominant kingdom. Wessex then became dominant, and there was this consolidation throughout the time of when the Vikings were capturing territory. But then Wessex was the only Saxon polity left standing by the end of it.
Right. Wessex is the last kingdom of the show.
Yes, it is the last kingdom. And Alfred actually was probably born in Mercia.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting. It seems like there was definitely a link between Mercia in central England, in the Midlands, and with Wessex, which was in the south. And these two were both much larger kingdoms than Northumbria or East Anglia. And they were the ones, Mercia and Wessex, that were foundational in basically establishing England. And it's kind of funny is that these are both kingdoms in the south. And from what I understand, the south of England has basically been the cultural center pretty much since then. So for like 1,200 years, since Wessex and Mercia started dominating the Heptarchy, they've been the center of England.
It's certainly been economically dominant.
Yeah, well, these ancient happenings have a very long shelf life. Just look at the current electoral map of Poland versus the borders of Prussia, for example.
Yeah. Poland A, Poland B. Yeah. But Russian Sam, tell us about what happened. You know, the four kingdoms live in harmony. Then what happens in the 9th century?
Basically, the Vikings showed up. You guys probably know who the Vikings are. Like, you can imagine them right now, like blonde hair, blue eyes, helmets with horns on their heads.
They didn't wear horned helmets.
Yeah. But yeah, the rest is, yeah.
I guess the popular image of them is kind of accurate. But there's been a bit of a Viking revival in the last couple of decades. Like, there was that show, Vikings, that was quite popular. But yeah, so who were the Vikings, actually? Well, the word Viking itself, it's a very old word. No one is 100% sure where it comes from. But right now, the predominant theory is that it may be related to the Norse word for nautical mile. But honestly, in outsider sources, they were more commonly referred to as Danes or Norsemen or just pagans/heathens. But it should be noted that the word used is pagan because it's going to be important later.
And one thing we should mention is that whatever we call them, the Vikings, Norsemen, Danes, whatever, they interestingly had sort of a common, arguably a common cultural origin with the Anglo-Saxons, because just like the Anglo-Saxons, they were migrants from the same part of Northern Europe, basically, from Scandinavia and Denmark in particular. And their language had only a few centuries earlier diverged from Old English, because these are both Germanic languages. So it seems like to some extent Old Norse and Old English were mutually intelligible. Maybe not completely, but the similarities are really clear. And even in the names, you see a lot of names that that are believed to be parallels. So for instance, the Mercian king Offa, who built a famous wall or a dike to protect against Welsh incursions, his name, which means something like little wolf, is a cognate with Ubba, who's a Viking we're going to talk about in this episode. They both have like the same origin, which is kind of cool. You know, one other thing that's kind of interesting is that, Beowulf is probably clearly the most famous work in Old English. But even though it's like it's an epic poem written in an Old English court, all of the characters are Scandinavian, and it takes place entirely in Scandinavia, which seems to clearly show the, you know, persisting cultural links with England and the continent.
Okay, so the Vikings started venturing abroad in the 8th century for a bunch of different reasons. Land in Scandinavia was getting scarce. The eldest son was the one who inherited the family land, and Ben, wishing to accumulate wealth, had to go abroad.
Just as an example of like of how bad the land situation and the climate situation was in Scandinavia, these guys get to England, and it's the most amazing climate I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's pretty telling.
England, of all places.
The shittiest, rainiest, just dreary place, the place that just produces miserable people and miserable culture.
England is Viking Miami.
God, cursed island. Anyways, this is a similar dynamic to what you saw with the Crusades, Spanish conquest of the Americas, the German Ostiedlung, and yeah, they wanted land, they wanted wealth, and they could not get this at home. So you have this, there was the release valve was just putting all these men on boats to England. There was also possibly a shortage of women due to the prevalence of polygamy, but that's another story.
Yeah, that's a little more contested, because I think that whether or not there was widespread polygamy among the Vikings is very controversial, but it definitely existed. So it's definitely possible that, like, you know, single men wanting wives could have been why these guys brought back so many people, especially women as slaves.
Yeah, they first started raiding the Baltic coast, but later went much farther afield. They eventually began to settle down as well, and, you know, in places like northern France, where they became the Normans.
Yeah, it's really remarkable with how wide a reach they had. They just settled down in many different places and made their mark felt. So, for example, the Normans, who would go on to invade England and establish their own dynasty in 1066, those guys were related to Vikings who had assimilated into a more French culture.
Oh, we mentioned it was a guy named, historically a guy named Rollo, or Rolf, was the, like, their, like, mythical ancestor.
Meanwhile, in what's today Russia and Ukraine, they became kings. They founded the Rurikid dynasty, supposedly because they were invited by the Slavs, who just kept fighting each other, and they asked these Norsemen to come and rule over them, which doesn't sound like a very plausible story to me, honestly.
It reminds me of the last Anglo-Saxon episode, how Hengist and Horsa were supposedly invited by some Celtic king named Vortigern, and it didn't end up too well for Vortigern.
Well, yeah, but it did end up well for the Slavs in this case, because Rurikids, they lasted until the 16th century.
Wow, that's wild. So, like, 800 years of this one dynasty.
Yeah, and then after that were the Romanovs.
Yeah, well, that's crazy. It's just two, in the entire history of Russia, basically just two royal houses.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I know that in these days, because that deep kind of like Norse influence, I understand that some Russian and Ukrainian nationalists try to insist that actually there were no Varangians, no Vikings at all. There was no Norse influence over the Rus.
Yeah, haven't really looked into it very closely. As far as I understand it, it's a minor phenomenon.
Well, of course, and the Rus had really deep connections across Eastern Europe, going all the way to the Black Sea and the Mediterranean.
Yeah, which, of course, resulted in something called the Varangian Guard in the Byzantine Empire, who were basically mercenaries who got incorporated into the Byzantine army, and they were fighting wars from the Balkans all the way into the Levant. And the funny thing about these guys is that the Vikings in general were a very literate people. They had their runic alphabet.
Yeah. Which we should add, it's appeared to be really unusual for this period of time, that just that this amount of literacy in this part of the world is pretty uncommon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we have a lot of fun stuff, like in the Hagia Sophia mosque, formerly church.
Formerly museum and as well.
Yeah, they just found a bunch of graffiti from these Varangians writing things like Halfdan was here, Arenbar cut these runes, that kind of stuff. They just, like, really love to let the world know that they were here.
They're just like us.
Yeah, and another interesting Viking artifact that contains runic writing is the so-called Piraeus Lion from Greece, which was actually carved 360 years before the Common Era.
So like a classical era, Athenian era lion statue.
Yeah, and both sides of it are carved with Viking runes, which are unfortunately very worn by the state. So, like, it's very difficult to get consensus about what exactly it says. But right now, it's in Venice. The Venetians just took it back home during one of their wars with the Ottomans.
They were the original Brits, weren't they? Looting antiquities wherever they found them. Well, one thing you found, Russian Sam, that I thought was incredible was that there was a not-so-successful Viking incursion into Islamic Spain, and that led to a kind of funny result.
So after an assault on Seville, some Vikings clearly decided that, oh, Spain is nice. This is great weather. Let's just settle down here. And they just converted to Islam and became cheesemakers.
Awesome.
I think, to be honest, I think those guys clearly made the right call, not the ones who settled in England.
Oh, God, yeah.
Possibly most famous of all, more recently, and most relevant to us in North America, is one other Viking settlement.
Yeah, they made it all the way to the Americas around the 11th century. That didn't really come to anything. They seem to not have had great relations with Native Americans, and their settlement was abandoned shortly after that, but...
It's hard to know if it really was a permanent settlement or just kind of like a trade post, but it's clear that the Vikings, the Norse, whatever you call them, the Vikings were part of this really well-connected world, much more well-connected than we might expect the early Middle Ages, you know, the so-called Dark Ages to be. And one of the places they ended up settling in England, which we'll come back to a lot in this episode, Jorvik, now it's called York, was this major trade center. Even though it's a city that we today don't associate with that much, you know, international prestige or whatever, it was this really happening place. So here, one book, this was Blood Feud, great title, by Richard Fletcher, mentions that, talking about a single street in York. Whetstones of Norwegian origin for sharpening the cooper's tools, handsome pitchers from Germany for the import of Rhenish wine, necklaces of amber from the Baltic, kernstones of the lava found near Mainz, and there were lots more exotic objects, indicators of more remote contacts. Silk from Constantinople, a cowrie shell from the Red Sea, and even a coin from Samarkand, which had traveled over 3,000 miles before coming to rest in York. And again, this is all on a single street, which really, I think, goes to show that the Norse were part of these really incredible networks of trade. Really, really incredible. And you know what, actually, Russian Sam, do you want to mention two other kind of famous artifacts?
So while I was researching this episode, I came across a couple of artifacts that I just fell in love with on first sight. The first one is called the Helgo Buddha.
This one's cool as hell.
It's a jade Buddha statue.
It was carved around the 6th century and is believed to be from the Indian subcontinent around Kashmir. It's in great shape. They just found this some time ago in Sweden. And another one that I'm a big fan of is a ring that was only discovered a couple of years ago, actually.
It's a simple ring with a stone, but the stone has a really unusual or a really surprising inscription.
It reads Lilla, which is like for Allah, in the Kufic script.
Yeah, so it's an Arabic Islamic inscription on this Viking artifact, which is awesome.
Yeah, so they had a very wide reach. But as much as I'd love to talk about the Vikings for the entire episode, we unfortunately have to go back to dreary old England.
Yes. Yes, like we said, some of these Vikings did not make the wise choice to settle in Spain and make cheese. Some of them did go to England. So you know what? How about this? What was the first known instance of Viking incursion into England?
Let's take it back to the year 793, and this is from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle.
Only 90s kids will remember this.
And we should add here, this is about, it's a famous name, this is about a monastery called Lindisfarne. And in the year 793, the monks there got a very rude awakening.
In this year, dire portents appeared over Northumbria and sorely frightened the people. They consisted of immense whirlwinds and flashes of lightning, and fiery dragons were seen flying in the air. A great famine immediately followed these signs, and a little after that, in the same year, on the 8th of June, the ravages of heathen men miserably destroyed God's church in Lindisfarne with plunder and slaughter.
Yeah, so this is how the Vikings got their start. They would just continue to do this for decades, targeting monasteries because, first of all, they were easy targets. They were unguarded. Like, the monks wouldn't have been much of a match against heavily armed Viking warriors. And second of all, they had a lot of very valuable stuff. Like, they didn't care for relics at all. They weren't Christian, but these relics were often housed in, like, these beautiful jeweled golden boxes and whatnot.
And if anyone's ever seen, you know, an English or Irish manuscript from this period, the books alone could be priceless just because the amount of gorgeous painting and illustration probably would have made them quite valuable.
We actually have another contemporary source that talks about this raid on Lindisfarne, which was written by this guy named Alcuin.
We should add, he was an Anglo-Saxon in the court of Charlemagne, which is kind of cool. So he was one of the most important English people of the 8th century.
And he wrote a letter to the king of Northumbria, who was called Ethelred, in response to this raid. So let's read through that, shall we? Lo, it is nearly 350 years that we and our fathers have inhabited this most lovely land, and never before has such terror appeared in Britain as we now have suffered from a pagan race.
One thing I just want to jump onto here is that even though he uses the word race, this was a religious conflict. It really seems like that, although like they talk about the Danes and they say things like a pagan race, really what mattered was not that these people spoke a different language, but they came from a different place. It was that they were not Christians. And that in this incredibly Christian world of 8th century Britain, the idea of pagan invaders was basically the most horrifying potentiality. It's people who do not share your values at all, coming only, as you can tell, to destroy. And it must have been a pretty apocalyptic feeling.
And also, if you are losing against these people, these pagans who do not have God's favor, and you have God's favor, well, that says something about you.
Behold, the Church of St. Cuthbert, splattered with blood of the priests of God, despoiled of all its ornaments, a place more venerable than all in Britain, is given as prey to pagan peoples. Consider carefully, brothers, and examine diligently, lest perchance this unaccustomed and unheard of evil was merited by some unheard of evil practice. Adulteries and incest have poured over the land, so that these sins have been committed without any shame. What may I say about avarice, robbery, violent judgments, when it is clearer than day how these crimes have increased everywhere, and the despoiled people testifies to it?
You know, I think this actually gives me a little bit of deja vu to the Gildas passage we read in the last Anglo-Saxon episode. And Gildas was a British monk, you know, in the sub-Roman period before the Anglo-Saxons got there, describing in very similar terms not only how he was being beset upon by pagans, but also that maybe they deserved it for being so sinful. And also it kind of makes me think that there's a little bit of an interesting rhyme here, how in the 4th and 5th and 6th centuries, you have people, Germanic-speaking pagans from the Denmark-Germany area coming to Britain to settle, and then now 350 years later, you've got people from that same part of the world coming again, and they're pagans once more. It's a pretty funny little repetition.
Man, your land must be just dog shit if England is fertile soil, and good lord.
Yeah, so again, this raid on Lindisfarne happened in 793, and for decades after that, this was basically something that would happen every couple of years, just a large fleet of Viking ships would show up.
You could argue, actually, that raid on Lindisfarne marked the start of something like about 300 years of Norse presence in England. Because basically, until the Norman conquest of 1066, you had constant Scandinavian settlements, raiding, interference, whatever you want to call it, in what is today England.
Yeah, and these people would just show up, raid year by year, and this is captured very well in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which was actually a project which seems to have been commissioned by Alfred, which is it's a medieval chronicle. It goes year by year talking about what happened in that year. It's mostly very dry, but there are some very exciting parts to it. Hello, Sam, why don't you take us away?
In this year, a great naval force arrived among the West Welsh, and the latter combined with them and proceeded to fight against Egbert, king of the West Saxons. When he heard that, he then went thither with his army, and he fought against them at Hingston Down, and put both the Welsh and Danes to flight.
Yeah, I noticed that they're attacking the western shore of Britain, and this is because the Vikings actually got very well entrenched in Ireland. In fact, the city of Dublin, which even today is the capital of Ireland, was founded as a Viking settlement.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely, yeah.
So this decade is particularly an active one for the Vikings. There's an entry for almost every year to the effect of, in this year, they raided and attacked and they plundered and they killed these nobles, or they were killed by these nobles, etc. But there was a change of pace in the year 851 when they suddenly did something they hadn't done before.
They started to settle. In this year, Alderman Churl, with a contingent of the men of Devon, fought against the heathen army at Wittenberg, and the English army made great slaughter there and had at the victory. And for the first time, heathen men stayed through the winter on Thanet. And the same year, 350 ships came into the mouth of the Thames and stormed Canterbury and London and put to flight Brithwulf, king of the Mercians, with his army and went south across the Thames into Surrey. And King Ethelwulf and his son Ethelbald fought against them at Aclea with the army of the West Saxons, and there inflicted the greatest slaughter on a heathen army that we ever heard of until the present day, and had the victories there.
Yeah, so this is basically what was going on. It seems like the general thrust of the 9th century is that the Vikings are starting to be increasingly bold. They're taking over increasing numbers of Anglo and Saxon kingdoms, like how East Anglia was just in Northumbria, both became Viking kingdoms. And then not only are they raiding everywhere, they're starting to settle. So it seems like there's going to be a permanent Norse presence in England, just like there's in Scandinavia. Not to dive too much into like great man models of history, but the really big change that was about to happen, which would sort of disrupt this, what was happening here, is King Alfred, who we'll talk about pretty soon.
Yeah, so as I've said before, this isn't the greatest show, not in terms of writing, not in terms of quality. And one of the things that really drove me up the wall is how every episode is introduced with a narration that's like, I'm Ettrid, the Ealdorman of Bebbanburg, and I was adopted by the Danes when I was a young boy, and then I was pursued by them for allegedly killing my father, which I was framed for, and then I made my way down to King Alfred's kingdom, and yada yada yada. And I was just like, Jesus Christ, man. Like, I can't put up with that. Come on, man.
Yeah. Well, what I think is kind of interesting about the show and the characters is that the characters are decently well written. That's definitely the best attribute the show has. And I think it's because, you know, Bernard Cornwell is a competent writer. And what I think is really interesting, though, is that besides characters like Alfred and Ubba and Guthrum, most characters in the show are fictional, but some of them are sort of composites based on real people that did exist. And I think that one of the most interesting examples is Uhtred himself. And I was kind of curious about this, and it turns out that Bernard Cornwell's real name is Bernard Uhtred, and that he came to believe that his unusual surname actually suggested that he was descended from a real-life Northumbrian nobleman named Uhtred, and that the character from this show is sort of based on a real person, just the big difference being that the real Uhtred, Uhtred of Bebbanburg, a real person, died around the year 1016. So he lived about 150 years after the Uhtred of this show.
But he was still fighting the Danes.
He was, actually. He wasn't fighting the great heathen army that we talked about before, the Grand Heathen Army, but he was fighting a Danish army, this time a Danish Christian army, led by Canute, friend of the pod, a famous Scandinavian king who actually ruled England. So yeah, he the real Uhtred was the Lord of Bebbanburg, which today is called Bamburg. It still exists in Northumbria. And he first came to attention by fending off a Scottish invasion, actually. And kind of the most famous thing about him is that when this city called Durham was being besieged, he led an army and routed the Scots and then cut all their heads off. And then famously, he gathered all the heads of the dead and put them all in the city walls. And I was wondering if Russian Sam, if you want to read what he did exactly with the heads.
Uhtred had the heads of the dead made more presentable, with their hair braided, as was then the custom, and transported to Durham. There they were washed by four women, and fixed on stakes round the ramparts. They gave the woman who had washed the head a cow each as payment.
That's again from Richard Fletcher, the writer we mentioned earlier.
Well, at least the woman got well compensated.
I think a cow a head is a great deal. But then 10 years later, like we mentioned, he would fend off another invasion. This one, it was round two of the Danes. So this is after this show takes place. There was a guy named Canute who was a Danish king. And in 1016, 50 years before the Normans, he successfully invaded England and brought it into this sort of united kingdom with Denmark and Norway. But unfortunately for Uhtred, on his way to swear fealty, he was captured and killed by a guy named Thorbrand the Hold. It was a pretty grim moment, and actually led to this basically a 60-year revenge cycle, which I find pretty interesting.
Yeah, so this is where the title of the book Blood Feud refers to, this practice of generational revenge. So coming back to Richard Fletcher. Earl Uhtred's son, by the name Aeldred, avenged his father's murder by slaying the killer, Thorbrand. Thorbrand's son Carl, in turn, avenged his father's death by killing Ealdred. In due course, Ealdred's grandson, Walthuf, contrived to avenge that murder by cornering all Carl's sons and grandsons when they were feasting together at a family estate not far from York and killing nearly all of them.
So we can see the real-life Uhtred had a pretty crazy life, and his descendants were even crazier. It's kind of like a real-life, Red Wedding kind of thing. And I think it's cool because it shows, like, this was the level of violence that existed at this time. This was an incredibly turbulent society, even after the Norman conquest, where these kinds of slaughters based on, you know, blood feuds or just base conquest would happen pretty frequently.
Yeah, and it's actually very interesting that this kind of behavior is common all across the world.
Sure, yeah. Like, blood feuds in Albania persisted well into the 20th century.
Albania is an infamous example. This continued until 1945.
Sicily.
And of course, the Sicilian blood feuds were brought over to New York and in Boston and near Chicago.
That's fucking right, baby.
Well, I guess someone who really, who I'm sure probably was involved in a few blood feuds himself, and who really is arguably the star of this series, or at least the real guiding light of The Last Kingdom, is the real-life King Alfred the Great, who I know you know quite a bit about, Russian Sam, if you want to tell us about him.
I came away from this admiring Alfred. He really does seem to have been a very competent ruler who got a lot done, although he was mythologized to a very large extent later by the Victorians, which we'll get into. But as for, like, the man himself, what we actually know about him, he was born around the year 848. He was the youngest of five sons, and it seemed that it would be very unlikely that he would actually take the throne. Although, you do get some weird stuff trying to make it seem like this outcome was predestined in retrospect. So, for example, in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, it says that when Alfred was just a little boy, him and his father went to Rome on pilgrimage, and supposedly Pope Leo was supposed to have anointed him as the future king. And the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle reads, 853, and that year, King Ethelwulf sent his son Alfred to Rome. The Lord Leo was then Pope of Rome, and he consecrated him king and stood sponsor to him at confirmation.
And I just want to add here, this is crazy, because not only is it unusual for a four-year-old to be proclaimed like a king while his father is still alive, but also we know from other sources that Alfred didn't immediately succeed his father to the throne of Wessex. He had older brothers who were king before him. He actually was, I believe, the third son of Ethelwulf to become king of Wessex.
Fifth.
Oh my god. Yeah, it's bullshit. It's like this clearly seems to be an example of, you know, scribes, possibly clergymen, writing this, like, you know, a puff piece about the current king to get his good graces.
Well, the thing about this is that we supposedly have a surviving letter, and this letter does seem to show that Alfred had indeed met the Pope, but basically it seems like what actually happened was that the Pope blessed him, not that he anointed him king or whatever. Although it should be noted that not everyone accepts the authenticity of this letter. Forgeries were a huge deal in medieval Europe. They just were constantly forging documents for whatever reason, just to show that they had reason to lay claim to this monastery or another.
For a while, didn't the Catholic Church claim to own every island in the world?
That's awesome.
The donation of Constantine, yeah. But yeah, and so King Alfred really is in many ways the center of this show. What I think is funny is that he's this pretty, you know, famous world historical figure, but just like with the figure of Cortez in the show Hernan, they try to make him more relatable in kind of a modern way. So I think that the big question about the depiction of Alfred in The Last Kingdom is he a sad boy or is he a fuck boy? And which one do you guys think is closer to the truth, to the real Alfred that we know?
Well, what do you guys think of the guy they got to portray Alfred in the show?
He's very dweeby. He's very English, very reedy.
Annoys me. I didn't care about him.
I don't care for him. He has creepy vibes. He's just not kingly at all.
I expect more charisma from a king.
Yeah, he's just constantly moping about the fact that he wants to eat meat because he's taken a vow to only eat gruel or whatever as penance for his sins.
I mean, come on, 60 million people eat English food every day. It can't be that bad.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk about these sins. So what do we know about... So that whole thing, Alfred's sins, which is a big part of the first season of the show, that is based on a part of the chronicle. Can you guys tell me what exactly Alfred's sin was?
He was horny on Maine.
Oh, God, yeah.
So he had to go to horny jail. The only other major source we have besides the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is Asser, who is a Welsh monk, and he talks about how exactly King Alfred came to be beset by horniness.
While his nuptials were being honorably celebrated in Mercia among innumerable multitudes of both sexes, and after long feasts by night and by day, he was suddenly seized in the presence of all the people by instant and overwhelming pain, unknown to any physician. Many thought that it was occasioned by the favor and fascination of the people who surrounded him, others by some spite of the devil, who was ever jealous of good men, others from an unusual kind of fever, while some others thought it was the ficus, which species of severe disease he had from his childhood.
Yeah, oh, I should add that, yeah, ficus or ficus, whatever it's called, that is the medieval name for hemorrhoids. So Asser is speculating that maybe, you know, he just had some booty pimples that were really bad.
Well, he wouldn't have been speculating. He was very close to the king. Like, the king would have told him this himself.
The king's just complaining about his hemorrhoids.
There must have been a reason why his name is Aster. Well, so what happened? So what did Alfred do to try to relieve his plight?
He besought the mercy of the Lord that, in his boundless clemency, Almighty God would exchange the torments of the malady which then afflicted him for some other lighter disease, provided that such disease should not show itself outwardly in his body, lest he should be useless and despised. For he had great dread of leprosy or blindness.
Damn, I guess Alfred was ableist.
When he had finished his praying, he felt that he had been divinely healed, or that disorder, and that it was entirely eradicated. But, sad to say, though it had been removed, a worse one seized him. He perceived that he could not abstain from carnal desires. This incessantly tormented him, night and day, from the 20th to the 45th year of his life. But if ever, by God's mercy, he was relieved from this infirmity from a single day or night, or even from the space of 1 hour, yet the fear and dread of that terrible malady never left him, but rendered him almost useless, as he thought, in every affair, whether human or divine. In other words, he made a deal with the devil in exchange for his hemorrhoids to go away. He'd have something less bad, and God just said, I'm going to make you horny all the time.
I just like the idea that, King Alfred, who we assume is this, incredibly able king, saw himself as rendered almost useless because he was so damn horny.
Yeah, he had JFK disease.
That's a good way to put it.
JFK claimed that he could not function without, fucking multiple women a day. At least it wasn't children, okay? Unlike the English today.
Hopefully not, yeah. God, Jesus. Yeah.
So that was a sample from Asser's biography of Alfred, which is the main source that we have for this reign. And this text is actually interesting in and of itself, because, first of all, even though it's very much a hagiographical account of Alfred, almost, it's clearly not entirely flattering.
Yeah, in contrast with the Chronicle, I would say.
It's very personal. Asser portrays Alfred as both a great figure, but also somebody who at the end of the day is a man who has his own foibles, who has to rub the hemorrhoid cream into his anus like the rest of us. And there's been a lot of speculation over the years about what the purpose of this was. Well, it seems likely to me that the reason why this was written in the first place is for a Welsh audience. If you guys picked up on this while you were reading, he's constantly mentioning the names of places as they would have been known in Welsh.
In Welsh, right. These Latin names, not English names.
One of the hypotheses seems to be that the intention here was to present King Alfred to a Welsh audience to show the kings of Wales that this is a great man and that they should submit to him, that they should join the realm, so to speak. And secondly, it's also not an entirely polished product. This survived until early modern times in a single manuscript, and it seems that this would have been a first draft, so to speak. It ends very suddenly. It has some very weird turns of phrases. And in general, it's just kind of incomplete seeming.
Hey, one thing I would add is that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle was written in English, hence the name. But Aster was writing in Latin, which might speak to the fact that he was looking toward a more international audience, because, Latin was probably more widely spoken in Wales than in England at its time.
So there's actually another example of a biography of a secular figure that survives to this day, and this would be Einhard's biography of Charlemagne the Great.
Yeah, that's a great example. That would have been a couple generations before King Alfred, but I wonder, it's possible that, Aster might have read Einhard's work about Charlemagne, especially because, famously Alcuin, who we mentioned earlier, was this one of the most famous scholars in Charlemagne's court, and he was himself English.
Yeah, there are some suggestions in the text that Aster might have been familiar with Charlemagne's biography. Having read it, how would you say the two compare?
I think that Charlemagne is depicted in a much more celebratory way. He's much more lionized than Alfred is. Alfred's flaws are heightened more, which is interesting. But one thing they share is that it explains how both of them were big patrons of learning, which I think that goes to show that if you want to be remembered well in history, you got to pay your scribes well. And they're going to write nice things about you.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of weaknesses, although Aster does show Alfred in his moments of weakness, at the end of the day, it's more often than not a very glowing piece of work. There's no doubt in my mind that the epithet the Great is something that Alfred truly learned.
Yeah, because in addition to, having this great victory over the Vikings that we're going to talk about, Alfred also appears to have been really fundamental in establishing a lot of the kind of legal traditions that would basically remain in England forever.
Yeah, and not just legal traditions. Some of the things that he's remembered for doing is the creation of a more sophisticated administrative state. Although it should be noted that some of the more recent scholarship argued that the administrative state that the Anglo-Saxons had built up by the time of the Norman conquest was actually only really consolidated in the late 10th century. Because there aren't contemporary sources that describe it in very great length.
We do know that he had this a major book of laws, though, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, the so-called Doom Book, which was basically a compendium of laws. Alfred looked over the actually existing laws, which had existed in his realm, which was now big. And he basically decided that he would create a reference book for judges and nobles across the kingdom to have a consistent set of laws. Liam, why don't you read Alfred's justification for...
And so this is supposedly in the words of Alfred the Great. "Then I, King Alfred, gathered them together and ordered to be written many of the ones that our forefathers had observed, those that pleased me, and many of the ones that did not please me. I rejected the advice of the counselors and commanded them to be observed in a different way, for I dared not to presume to set down in writing all or many of my own, since it was unknown to me which laws should please those which came after us. But those which I found either in the days of Ine, my kinsmen, or of Offa, king of the Mercians, or of Ethelbert, first among the English people to receive baptism, and which seemed the most just, I collected herein and omitted the rest."
Yeah, so that's Alfred for you. But there's also some darker sides to his legacy, which we unfortunately can't really suss out because so much of what we have of Alfred in terms of the running of the state is in such glowing terms. But one fact that I came across, which left me a bit stunned, frankly, is the fact that Alfred is very known for currency reforms that took place during his reign. And what I learned is that this was a massive deal. Like, coins in England went from being made of 20% silver to 90% silver.
Which immediately begs the question, where was all that silver coming from?
Yeah, and it would seem one of the obvious answers would be perhaps a slave trade, because the Vikings themselves were in need of slaves, but also they set up a trade network for slaves in the Arab world.
And these trade networks existed before the Vikings, these slave trade networks, and would be very important. Like, supposedly the name Angle was chosen over the name Saxon because a pope saw Angle slaves for sale in Rome and thought they looked angelic, and compared the Angles to angels. And in another slave reference is that we mentioned the Doom Book. There's the more famous Doomsday Book, which was written about 150 years later under the early Norman kings. And according to that book, something like up to 20% of English people, as late as the like 1060s, may have been slaves.
Holy shit.
Do we know what this slavery would have consisted of?
That's a really good question. Like we said, it can't be compared to the American slavery that we know. I think that typically slavery in England, certainly slavery in Scandinavia, it probably was a very extreme form of serfdom. It probably would have been inherited from, you know, parent to child, so you could be born a slave. But at the same time, there were, at least in Scandinavia, there were varying degrees of enslavement. So it seems like if you were the son of a slave in Sweden, you would still be considered a slave, but you'd have an easier time becoming free. But your father, who had been the first generation to be enslaved, he would probably be a slave for his whole life. And then, so it seems like it was a little bit more fluid than you saw in other places. But it still, I'm sure, was a very oppressive system for a lot of many, many people.
Oh yeah, for sure. And speaking of slavery, we actually do get a glimpse of it in the show itself. As we mentioned, Uhtred is first taken as a slave before his family takes a liking to him because he really has a fighting spirit and a sense of justice. So ultimately, he becomes adopted. So he becomes the son of this Earl Ragnar rather than just like a household slave.
Yeah, and I think that probably is not uncommon. If you look in the Norse sagas, you find a lot of characters who have either are mentioned as former slaves or the children of slaves, or they have non-Scandinavian names, which some historians infer means that they are of foreign origin, which might mean that they are of slave origin, because so many foreigners in Scandinavia were slaves. And this is, I guess, outside Scandinavia proper, but Iceland, just as an example of the modern legacy of this, people in Iceland are genetically very, very closely related to the people of Ireland, even though it was uninhabited before the Vikings got there. Which probably means that the Vikings got to this uninhabited island and they couldn't get enough settlers there, so they just brought over a ton of Irish peasants as slaves. And it left a permanent mark on the gene pool of Iceland.
Oh, so it's just Boston in the Arctic.
Yeah, maybe so. Well, what did Alfred do as a warrior? Because I know he had one other famous reform that also supposedly also helped defeat the Vikings.
Well, first of all, he personally led a large number of battles against the Vikings, which is what brought him a lot of renown. But also, he made a lot of changes to the way that the English would fight in this period. We see a bit of a dramatization of this embodied in Uhtred. Like, he introduces the tactic of the shield wall to Anglo-Saxon warriors in the show, for example. And that doesn't strike me as something that's inconceivable. It seems like the Vikings were the first ones to bring the shield wall tactic to the British Isles. But we do see in the sources that the English came to embrace this tactic as well. But one of the bigger things that he did in terms of military reforms was the creation of what has been called the Burgle Hidage, which was basically a system of fortifications or burgs and defenses which were built across the country, which were approximately 30 kilometers apart from each other. This was also accompanied by a well-maintained road network to make sure that troops would be able to travel from one burg to another, to make sure that reinforcements were sent wherever they were needed in case the Vikings were to attack. Because the Vikings did continue to try to make raids into Wessex proper, even after they had made a peace with Alfred. Like, one thing to keep in mind about the Vikings is that these weren't really exactly one people under one polity, per se. These were basically warlords at the head of a conglomeration of men of varying sizes. And just because you might have a peace with one of them doesn't mean that the others are going to maintain friendly relations with you.
And that's what you see in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, is that it'll say that Alfred made a peace with one Viking king, with one Danish king, and then the next year, another Danish king leads an incursion into England.
But yeah, this Burgle system would have required a total of 27,000 men to man it in its entirety. We don't know to what extent it was always manned, but for this time, for this part of the world, that's massive.
And a lot of these burgs are actually still standing today in the form of cities. Like, for instance, Winchester was a burg, which ended up becoming the capital of England before the Normans. And then other ones are Bath, you know, the famous, you know, resort town. That was repopulated after Roman times as a burg. And then one other ones that you guys are probably going to recognize, that this name you'll know, Buckingham was a burg.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure if these were all set up by Alfred himself, but these were all burgs that were established in the Viking era by Anglo-Saxon kings to defend against the Vikings.
Yeah, speaking of burgs, another interesting fact that I came across while doing research is that some of the burgs were actually refortified at the beginning of World War II in case the Germans had actually invaded.
That makes a lot of sense, honestly.
We touched on how Alfred also was something of a scholar. I was wondering if, Halal Sam, you want to tell us about that?
So Alfred didn't learn to read until age 12, but he was strongly interested in education nonetheless.
And we actually see a great demonstration of this in Asser's biography, where one of the first things we learn is that the young Alfred, where the mother of Alfred basically told Alfred and his brothers that whichever one of them could learn a book of poetry by heart first would get it. And so Alfred, being the intellectual of the bunch, took the book to his teacher, who read it out loud to him until he was able to memorize it, and thereby he won the book. So in this way, Asser shows that Alfred was a man of letters from his earliest days.
So he lamented England's poor state of learning, and he thought the cause of this was the Viking invasion.
Oh, so hold on. So he thought that because England had a bad education system, they were punished by God to be beset with Vikings?
Yeah, because if they have a bad education system, education back then meant the Bible and these various theological texts. So if you have a poor knowledge of the faith, then of course God is going to punish you.
Of course. It's totally possible that Alfred believed that. I also have to wonder if that's Asser editorializing, you know?
Yeah, same. It's, oh, this good, pious man.
Maybe if they would have treated us monks better, would have given us more teaching jobs, maybe these Vikings wouldn't have come along.
So he set up the system of courtly schools and English education and translations. He's personally reputed to have translated a bunch of works from Latin into English. So he definitely spoke fluent Latin.
I'm a little skeptical of that. I think that if you're like spending your entire life battling the Vikings, I don't think you have time to translate a book, but who knows? No, yeah, even though Alfred is not a saint, as far as I know, he is treated almost as such because of his profound role in repelling this heathen threat. And we haven't really said this explicitly, but one thing that Alfred is really known for, which we're going to talk about soon, is he's really seen as foundational in paving the way toward a unified English kingdom. And I believe at one point, we mentioned in the last episode, he actually called himself King of England or King of all the Anglo-Saxons, something like that.
Yes, yes, King of the English. That was one of them.
So we can talk about unifying England in a minute. Before that, before we get onto that, let's talk about who exactly the Vikings were, as represented in this show, The Last Kingdom, and what we know about them.
So the main Viking that we see in the show is this guy named Ubba. And Ubba was a bad dude. He ran with a bunch of bad boys.
He was supposedly a son of Ragnar Lothbrok. And a lot of our listeners are going to know that name because in the show Vikings, you mentioned a couple times, he's the main character. Ragnar Lothbrok was this maybe mythological, maybe real Danish Norwegian chieftain. And a lot of the people invading England as part of this great heathen army were his sons. And Ubba was probably foremost among them.
Yeah, and I believe we already mentioned that there was an English king by the name of Offa, which is actually a cognate of Ubba.
Yeah, means wolf.
Not just wolf, like a diminutive form of wolf. So like little wolf.
Yeah, wolf pup. Puppy.
He's a deeply unpleasant guy in the show. He's like basically like this giant meathead who is very cruel and very capricious and who decides his course of action by consulting his magician, Snorri, who gets pegged, by the way.
I think what I like about Ubba is that he's kind of awkward, which is a funny trait to give to like a Viking chieftain. Like, I remember at one point he gets really self-conscious because someone suggests that he's old. And it's kind of like, that's the thing that I like about this show, is that there are these kind of human moments. Some of the human moments are hard to believe. Like, I think that the main character is a little bit too modern in how he acts. But I'm sure that some of these human moments really would have happened in the 9th century. I'm sure there were Viking kings who were very self-conscious, the way that Ubba is.
Yeah, Ubba was just a soft boy who was suffering from anxiety disorder. He just wanted to win daddy's approval, which is why he conquered England, you know?
Maybe so, you know. And so speaking of his dad, you know, other sons of Ragnar Lothbrok that we should mention, there was Ivar the Boneless, who's not a part of this show. He's a character in Vikings. But what's interesting about Ivar is that he was a major figure in Irish history because he was really foundational in just bringing the Norse to Ireland. For about half of the first season, Ubba is also in Ireland. And there's a big kind of thing about like, oh, when's Ubba going to return? Are we prepared? He's so scary. And then another important king is Guthrum, who is king of East Anglia. And another one is Halfdan, who was important in settling Danes into Northumbria. But how about this? Can you tell us about Guthrum, Halal Sam?
Yes, let's get to Guthrum. So after he lost the Battle of Edington in 878...
Let me just add right here, that was the fundamental battle between King Alfred and the Vikings. This was this huge event that led to sort of... We'll talk about it here.
Yeah, and also we should say what Edington is and where Edington is. It's Wiltshire is where it is. I'm probably butchering that.
Yeah, like it's well into Wessex.
Okay, yeah. So it was a battle like deep in the heart of Wessex. The Vikings were probably getting pretty scarily close to a lot of really important strategic locations for the Wessexans. But so let's see. So what happens here? There's a battle. The Anglo-Saxons win. The Vikings lose. And what does Guthrum do?
So he agrees to be baptized after he lost the Battle of Edington under the new name Æthelstan.
Which I could just add, I find kind of interesting because that's just a Saxon name. That's not a biblical name. He could have been, you know, John or James, but no, he just took, for some reason, like, this shows the deep connection between culture and religion. Like, for Guthrum to become a Christian, it was almost as if he was becoming an Englishman.
Exactly.
Although, of course, he did create a kingdom, which would later be known as what?
The Danelaw, maybe. So he formalizes the Danish kingdom. It's in the north and east. And there's an English kingdom in south and west.
Yeah, you've got kind of like an east and west Germany thing for a while. I don't know how long the Danelaw was a coherent kingdom, but for about a century and a half or something, up until the unification, or maybe a century, up until the unification of England, you have this whole chunk of the country where Danish speakers, or at least their descendants, are prominent. And the legal system is based on Scandinavian laws, not based on English laws. And so even after these parts of the country came under West Saxon or Mercian control, they would often still keep these Danish customs. And a lot of Danish people would have lived here.
Yeah, but of course, the thing about the Danelaw is that it wasn't really an entity per se. It was more like the area where the Danes can do their own thing. So it wouldn't have been like a single coherent kingdom.
Yeah. So you know what, Halalsan, what does the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle say about the foundation of the Danelaw?
So the same year Rollo penetrated Normandy with his army, often divided the land of the Northumbrians. His armies proceeded to plow and support themselves. And in this same year, the army of the Danes in England swore oaths to King Alfred upon the Holy Ring, which before this they would not do to any nation, and they pledged to speedily depart from his kingdom. This is 876.
At the time, or at least in the recent memory, it did seem like the Danes had started to settle. This agreement was made, a semi-permanent truce was made between the newly Christianized Danish kingdom, whatever it was, this Danish zone, the Danelaw, and the sort of Mercian Wessex zone under Alfred and his descendants' dominion.
So this is actually an interesting question, because in the English national imagination, Alfred is pictured as the one who really unified England.
More complicated than that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a matter of dispute to what extent this was unification.
I'm sure that at the time there probably would have been English noblemen who were horrified at the idea of this kind of settlement with the Danes, because it basically is it's a truce. It's an allowance of the Danes to remain in England, at least for some time, on the condition that they become Christian, which I find quite interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, like, at a certain point, like, these two sides had fought each other for many, many battles. They both lost many men, and at a certain point, it just seemed to make rational sense. But yeah, so this theme of Alfred as unifier has been brought into question by more critical histories. One book that I used to research this episode was titled The Formation of the English Kingdom in the 10th Century by George Molyneux, which is interesting. It basically goes into how the Anglo-Saxon state, how the English kingdom came to be administered. But it also argues that the more salient objection to the concept of unification is that the 11th century kingdom did not encompass all those who were understood by contemporaries to be English. As such, it is inaccurate to describe what happened in the 10th century as, quote-unquote, the unification of the English. Nor is it helpful to think in terms of the unification of the English kingdom, since the kingdom did not previously exist in some fragmented form, waiting to be assembled. The word unification should therefore be eschewed.
The idea of eventuality is really common in like mainstream popular British nationalism. The idea that England as a unified single country had to happen.
It was inevitable. It's the same thing Spanish nationalists think about what we call the Reconquista.
I know, absolutely. Like, yes, that's a great comparison.
Yeah, and really, had it not been for the impetus of the Viking invasion wreaking havoc on the island and allowing a large chunk of what remained to be reconstituted under the label of Wessex and later England, it's equally possible that it could have been a Wales-type situation, which never unified, just remained like five different kingdoms. Going back to Molyneux. The word unification is strongly associated with the so-called Italian and German unifications of the 19th century. Indeed, the Oxford English Dictionary records no use of the term in English before 1848, when it appears in a passage about recent and anticipated events in Italy. Talk of 10th century English unification implicitly suggests that the events of that period should be compared to the much later unifications of other European peoples. So basically, this would have been an example of them flouting English exceptionalism. Like, we did it a century before the rest of you guys did. That's why we're so special. That's why we're hot shit. Like, no one can really stand up to us, you know? What happened in the 10th century was that a series of kings extended their domination over a relatively large territory and intensified their hold of some of it. This was not an unusual phenomenon in early medieval Europe, and we need not seek an extraordinary explanation for it. Yeah, so what happened with the Danelaw, William?
Sure, yeah. So yeah, the Danelaw had a kind of cool legacy. So, of course, eventually it would be incorporated into the broader Anglo-Saxon kingdom, the Kingdom of England, but there are some kind of cool remnants today. Probably the biggest remnant of Danish rule in England is that there is a permanent Danish influence on the English language. And supposedly, in like the High Middle Ages, Northern England had a very different, much more Danish-influenced dialect. But some aspects that have come into mainstream English, any place name ending in Thorpe, or any last name ending in Thorpe, like Oglethorpe, that suggests Norse heritage. Another kind of cool example is that the words they and them are both Scandinavian introductions. Those words didn't exist in Old English. The idea of these, you know, collective third-person pronouns.
Yeah, and in general, the Norse had a huge influence on the English language. In fact, I've seen it argued that the reason why English came to lose its case system for the most part, which survives today in German.
In German, which, yeah, it's a huge pain in the ass for anybody who tries to learn German.
I've seen it argued that it faded away because you suddenly had this massive influx of these Norse speakers, which, although their language was mutually intelligible with English to some degree, did have cases, but they were different from the ones that were used in Old English. And so as these people came to adopt the language, they simplified it in the process.
Which makes sense because it would have, yeah, because it would have been that the Norse would have been the ruling class, but they also would have been like L2 English speakers, which is kind of funny. So, like, they constructed a new prestige dialect, which was English as they spoke it, which is pretty cool. You know, speaking of the Norse as, you know, prestige rulers, there's one other kind of theory that I think is kind of cool. How we might have mentioned Beowulf earlier. So Beowulf is such an important English piece of Old English literature, but it's not set in England. It's set in Sweden and Denmark, and all of the characters are Danish and Swedish. So there's actually one theory, which I think is kind of cool, that rather than hearkening back to an earlier continental heritage of the Anglo-Saxons, some historians think that Beowulf might have been commissioned on behalf of a Danish ruler. It was an English poet who was paid by a Danish king to write a piece of literature that showed the shared heritage of the English and the Danes, which I think is kind of cool. And one other cultural artifact of this period, so you know how we mentioned Guthrum, the guy before? Could you tell us, Russian Sam, what's another important thing that Guthrum does before his conversion to Christianity in the show, in The Last Kingdom?
In the show, we see this guy named King Gedmund, who is one of the many kings.
King of East Anglia.
Yes, East Anglia. And so he's captured by the Danes. And essentially, like they're keeping him prisoner. They're torturing him. And eventually, he tells them that he's going to submit his kingdom to them if they embrace Christianity. And so they start chatting about Christianity, and he's talking about, oh, well, God is great. He does miracles. And one of the examples of the miracles that he gives is like, so for example, he protects the saints, and he tells them the story of Saint Sebastian, who, of course, was one of the
early Roman martyrs.
Yes, one of the early Roman martyrs who was shot full of arrows, but he still survived until they...
I think they clubbed him to death or something. The Roman soldiers, you know, a nasty bunch.
Yeah, so in the show itself, the Vikings are like, okay, here's a deal for you. We'll shoot you full of arrows, and if you survive, we'll become Christian.
Yeah, so tragically for King Edmund, he did not survive. He was martyred, and he ended up becoming a saint, which is interesting. And there's even a theory, actually, that whole cool story, which is shown in the show, never happened. Instead, it might have actually been fabricated, basically, as a way to bring the character of Guthrum, this well-known, celebrated Norse figure, into the Christian kind of like cosmology, which is kind of interesting. Explaining, basically, it's a way to connect this well-known king to the Christian English as a way to convince the Danish to become Christian. So here is the historian Francis Young writing in 2018, "The enthusiasm with which Vikings embraced the figure of the martyred King Edmund suggests that his commemoration became a way of forging a common Anglo-Danish identity for the people of Eastern England, an identity which would become even more important as Danish kings once again dominated England in the 11th century." So we kind of see that, like, even though the Vikings proper wouldn't control much of England for that long, there is this lasting Scandinavian cultural legacy in Britain, which is pretty cool. I know that, like we mentioned, in Ireland, there were Norse speakers for a really long time. In Scotland, Norse speakers developed their own dialect called Norn, which I believe would persist until, like, the 16th century or something.
Especially in those outlying islands, I think, right?
Yeah. And I guess some of those islands, like the Faroes, they still speak Norse today, which is pretty cool. So, yeah, so even though... And then, of course, Canute would come again, and Britain basically would remain in the Nordic orbit for a long time. And that's pretty cool. So that's kind of the legacy here. Now, what about King Alfred? What is his role? Just to wrap this episode up, how does King Alfred remain in the popular imagination? So we've seen, you know, sad boy Alfred, fuck boy Alfred from this TV show, but how do you think most people today who are familiar with King Alfred think about him?
Well, perhaps the most famous tale of Alfred is the story of the burnt breads. which is an interesting one. It's not a contemporary story, although it was written down sometime in the late 11th or early 12th century, so it's not a modern invention either. But it appears in this book called The Life of Saint Neot, which was Hagiographies of Saints. And in this book, we see a humorous incident that happened to Alfred recounted, where Alfred had lost the battle, and him being a sad boy and all, decided to just run away from the world, disguise himself, and he decided to just hang out for a while with a regular herder. Noticing the cottage of a certain unknown swineherd, he directed his path toward it and sought there a peaceful retreat. He was given refuge, and he stayed there for a number of days, impoverished, subdued, and content with the bare necessities. One day, the king remained alone at home with the swineherd's wife. The wife had entrusted some kneaded flour to the oven. When she sought the bread from the oven, she saw it burning from the other side of the room. She immediately grew angry and said to the king, unknown to her as such, "Look here, man, you hesitate to turn the loaves which you see to be burning, yet you're quite happy to eat them when they come warm from the oven." But the king, reproached by these disparaging insults, ascribed them to the divine lot. Somewhat shaken and submitting to the woman's scolding, he not only turned the bread, but even attended to it as she brought out the loaves when they were ready.
Well, I think it's just kind of a cute story, because it shows that in this, like, you know, incredibly parochial early medieval context, it doesn't matter that Alfred is the king. He's just some asshole who didn't take the bread out of the oven. Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, there are a ton of fun Alfred stories. Like, for example, another popular one is that he dressed up as a musician and he walked into the Viking camp so he can spy on them.
Who knows? Maybe this happens. You know, I know one thing that you found that I thought was kind of funny, a good example of, like, the popular imagination, was this Charles Dickens text, A Child's History of England.
King Alfred never rested from his labors to improve his people. He had studied Latin to translate Latin books into the English Saxon tongue. He made just laws that they might live more happily and freely. It was a common thing to say that under the great King Alfred, the garlands of golden chains and jewels might have hung across the streets, and no man would have touched one. He founded schools. He patiently heard causes himself in his court of justice. The great desires of his heart were to do right to all his subjects. Under the great Alfred, all the best points of the English Saxon character were first encouraged, and in him first shown. It has been the greatest character among the nations of the earth. Wherever the descendants of the Saxon race have gone, have sailed, or otherwise made their way, even to the remotest regions of the world, they have been patient, persevering, never to be broken in spirit, never to be turned aside from the enterprises on which they have resolved. Whatsoever that race goes, there, law and industry, and safety for life and property, and all the great results of steady perseverance are certain to arise.
Wow. Hey, it wouldn't be a Gladiator for Europe episode without a little reference to some odious 19th century nationalism. And then thanks for reading that, because it shows that, you know, it's when you talk about these great figures, when you bring up this, like, sort of, you know, the idea that history is but the biography of a few great men, that has some pretty unfortunate implications for the descendants of these people. If Alfred is so great, does that mean that the English are greater? Clearly seems to think that Charles Dickens, you know, for all his many good qualities, he seems to be a bit of an English chauvinist. And I think it's important to note that, you know, he mentions, you know, wherever the Saxons should happen to go. He was writing in the early middle 19th century, where the Saxons, being the Brits, were everywhere. Where it almost, you have to wonder if he was trying to justify the ongoing colonization of Asia and Africa by the virtues of King Alfred 1,000 years before.
Yeah, and of course, let's note that this is a children's history of England. This was intended to be read by children. He was inculcating in English children this idea that we are a nation whose duty it is to extend our rule across the world so that there may be justice. Each of us is a little King Alfred who is going to create the kingdom of heaven on earth.
A civilizing mission.
It's another our ancestors, the Gauls, all over again. And I think that's a good way to show that when medieval history tends to recur in the modern imagination, more often than not, it's tragically in this kind of nationalist context. Because this is the time, that is the context where it's most important to bring up these like legitimizing forces of history.
Yeah, and the Victorians took this in a very interesting direction because they ascribed a lot of stuff to Alfred. Like, for example, it was often said that Alfred was the first one to create the navy, that since he was an economic reformer, the system that he set up is implied to have been sort of a laissez-faire trade system.
Oh, yeah. God, and of course, there is this, we touched on this before, but there just is this really unfortunate, you know, connection between the Anglo-Saxons and racialism and reaction. Like, you mentioned that the idea that King Alfred had anything to do with a laissez-faire economy. I believe that until pretty recently, maybe to the present, the phrase the Anglo-Saxon system or the Anglo-Saxon model was used to describe the sort of laissez-faire system that was supposedly natural to Britain and the USA.
Sam, can you tell us about who G.K. Chesterton was and why he's become popular with right-wing nerds today?
Well, G.K. Chesterton was a very popular writer at the turn of the 20th century and also an adult convert to Catholicism, which
explains a lot about his writing.
Oh, yeah. It happens a lot these days.
And basically, I follow some right-wing people on Twitter just to get a sense of what they're talking about. And recently, I've been seeing more and more of them reference Chesterton, who, aside from being a poet and a novelist, also wrote some not great stuff, honestly. But he's also quite famous for his poem called The Ballad of the White Horse, which is perhaps the last English language epic poem. It's quite long. It's like 200 pages, and it's all about Alfred.
It sucks ass. To be blunt, it's half of this is about the good virtues of these good Christian men and the heathen Danes. Although one thing that's really interesting about it is how Chesterton makes Scandinavian and Nordic looks to be sinister. Like he describes them as he only heard the heathen men whose eyes are blue and bleak. Our towns were shaken of tall kings with scarlet beards like blood. The world turned empty where they trod, and they took the kindly cross of God and cut it up for wood.
The men of the East may spell the stars and times and triumphs mark, but the men signed of the cross of Christ go gaily in the dark. The men of the East may search the scrolls for fates and fame, but the men that drink the blood of God go singing to their shame. You know, I think this is interesting because the fact that even though Vikings and Scandinavians, Germanic peoples are often celebrated by white supremacists. Chesterton, who was at the very least adjacent to white supremacists, he doesn't see them that way. Instead, he calls them Easterners. And I find that really telling. It's like how the Germans were called the Huns in World War I. The fact that, you know, the geographic Western position of Britain is seen as the mark of civilization, not the supposed shared racial heritage between them and the Norse. And I find that's like, I think it's interesting.
It's like how there's that Chinese novel, Journey to the West, that's about a journey to India. The West is India in that perspective.
This reminds me of that passage from Benjamin Franklin where he talks about the swarthy races such as the Swedes and the Russians.
How the English are the only real civilized white people or whatever in his mind. Yeah. Yeah, the Angles and the Saxons and the Vikings have been a very winding road from the 9th century to now in our popular imagination. And I think it's fun to see how they recur in pop culture. You know, it's a shame that The Last Kingdom isn't a better depiction of this time period, because it really was such a wild and foundational time period in creating England and Britain as we know it. But I don't think the show is totally without its merits. I think it's kind of fun. There's some bad moments, there's some good moments, but it definitely gives you a lot to think about when thinking about this interesting time period.
I would like to see more media about this, better media, but certainly more, because it is, like Liam said, a really interesting and pivotal time.
Yeah.
But I should say that I lost all sympathy for the show with the second half of the last episode, where Uhtred just turns into fucking Superman because one of the Vikings shows him the head of his glover, and he just like jumps over the Viking shield wall and starts slaughtering them.
Yeah, that's the problem. Oh, yeah. Well, at the end of the day, you know, a cheesy show about Vikings, even if it's about real English history and Norse history, is still a cheesy show about Vikings. But hey, that's why people love them.
We love it, folks, don't we? We love it.
This was another episode of Gladiator for Europe. Thank you guys all for joining me. Thank you so much, Russian Sam, for compiling all this information. And yeah, we are signing off.
See you around.